listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 161 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me today is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
Good. We're in the middle of a surprise snowstorm over here on the Northeast, which, I mean, I guess it wasn't a total surprise. I knew there was going to be a little snow, but it ended up being way more than I thought. So as I look out the window, it's coming down pretty good.
Oh, well, you have some sledding ahead of you this weekend, I guess.
Yep, that's exactly it. My daughter, I mean, that's, you know, anytime it snows, that's, let's go sledding, let's go outside.
So, yep. Yeah,
I have no choice.
How's the year of Chris coming along?
Pretty good. I did my 7-night residency in Portland, Oregon to celebrate the upcoming release of my new album, which I guess we'll talk about a little later.
Yeah, you've got
our discussion.
I guilted you into actually doing a lot of content capture. After our last episode of the podcast where I gave you a hard time, you actually did come through. And
I did. I have yet to piece it all together. And, you know, there's hiccups with that sort of thing because the first couple nights I was trying to figure out how the Zoom recorder works with the room mics. And then, you know, and then when we finally had a camera person there besides me just setting up some GoPros and an iPhone, when we actually had a real camera person there, I didn't press record. I thought I did on the Zoom recorder. So they have footage, but they don't have good audio. So then it's suddenly Wednesday night, and then things started to finally kind of come together at that point. But and then by the last night, a friend of both of ours, Tony, came out and filmed some stuff that I'm pretty sure the audio is good. So I'll work. I think probably have 4 or 5 videos at least that'll be, you know, good quality, and then I might have a few more that are pretty budget. But
the important thing is you got some stuff. All that effort, you got some stuff to use throughout the rest of the year.
Yeah, and you know, the other cool thing about playing in one place for that many nights in a row is you can kind of call upon a bunch of different resources like that. You know, there were, 3 different camera people. I had, you know, friends come out and let me borrow some room mics. I had maybe 3 different friends who are, you know, decent to very good photographers come out and take a bunch of pictures, and so they hand me flash drives at the end of the week with 300 photos that I have to go through. And
yeah, one of the photos I saw that you posted online was really cool, and I look forward to seeing more of them.
Yeah, I'll have a Facebook post for the rest of the year. People will be like, I don't give a damn about this residency you played in January anymore. It's June. Stop it.
Well, you don't tell them it's from them. As far as they know, it happened last night.
it's just a picture with no caption.
You just put a story behind it that is unrelated to the venue. That's actually, I've been doing, I've been wanting to do an episode of find somebody who's calls themselves like an Instagram marketing guru, because there's lots of cool tricks you can do on Instagram that, you know, you put a story behind it, tag certain people, use certain hashtags, and suddenly you've got people, you know, getting into your music in ways you never thought possible.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that I've scheduled a post for Facebook for later today, which is the entire list. I learned or relearned about 85 to 90 songs for this thing, and I actually only played about 65 of them. You know, I planned to do more, but things happen, and I liked certain songs, so I played them again. And then, but so my Facebook post later today is going to be the list of all the ones I actually played throughout the week and just kind of asking people which ones they liked the most. But I thought, how am I going to share that on Instagram? So I've been trying to think of, like, you know,
here's how you do it. Well, you can make a photo of, you know, so they're teeny tiny, which would sort of be ridiculous with that many songs. But what you should do is go to Spotify and make a playlist of all those songs.
Brilliant.
And then when you share it on Instagram, you change the link in your profile to the link to the Spotify playlist, and you tell people the story about the week, and then you tell them to click the link in the profile. That's what people do on Instagram.
I'm starting to see that there's a reason why you're a music marketer. It's not just all smoke and mirrors.
No. Okay. You know, only part of it. But yeah, that's how
you do it.
I
like that idea.
And then people, you tell a compelling story, use one of those cool photos, tell them the link of all the songs you played, tell them how your goal was to learn 80-some songs, but you only did 65. And, you know, on Instagram, the cool thing is you can type as much as you want. There may be a limit at some point, but people put paragraphs and paragraphs. And if it's compelling, I like it as a format because the photo is still, you know, you can have different size photos now and video. It doesn't have to all be square, but it's still the format itself is pretty much held and contained in a standard format. So when people scroll through, if they want to read, they can click to open up and see more, and it's there. But if not, it's not like it becomes this cluttered mess. But yeah, that's what you should do.
Love it.
So Chris, big month here at CD Baby. We've got a very special offer going on right now for the whole month of February, which has 29 days. Did you know that, Chris?
Unlike most other Februaries, yes, very special.
This one is very special. Has 29 days. And so for the whole month of February, we're doing $29 album submissions. That means for $29, you get your music distributed to all the retailers around the world. You get CD sales if you have CDs to sell. You get YouTube monetization, sync licensing. You get, what else do you get? I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Also,
promo tools like our music player. Let's see. You get physical distribution to about 1,500 record stores around the world.
That's right. And never will we charge you annual fees. Nothing bums me out more than when I meet an artist and they tell me they got tired of paying annual fees using a different distributor and pulled their back catalog down. Because in this day and age, it's so important that you build a catalog of your music. There is no shelf life in the digital world. You want all your music available all the time so your fans can buy it, stream it, download it, whatever they do with it. You want them to discover it all, and that just drives more revenue for you. So this is the perfect time to release an album or switch from another distributor. Just sign up at members.cdbaby.com. Use the coupon code 29 for 29, and that's 29, F-O-R, 29. You'll get your music out there for just $29. We want to be a partner in your success, not a bill collector every year. I don't want to be your bill collector. I want to be there to deliver money every week as you're excited to make things happen. So perfect time. And we also have brand new Spotify daily trending reports. I think we're the first distributor to do this. I looked at some other folks and they didn't have it, but daily graphs of what's happening on Spotify. We kind of did a beta launch right before Christmas. And as many of you know, who've been listening to the podcast for a long time, I have Christmas albums out with Small Town Poets. So it was really cool to be able to watch the trends on a daily basis of how people were engaging with the music as Christmas approached, and then how it dropped off like a rock after Christmas. But new Spotify trending reports, and we just launched Lander integration, so you can master your tracks right inside your CD Baby member account. Lots of cool stuff happening. I'm really excited. And so 29 for 29, this is the month to do it. And Chris, you even starred in some hilarious videos.
I was going to say, yeah, if you're fans of sport, you know, over dramatic sports documentaries, we have a mockumentary available on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, which is, what is it? CD Baby Video, I think. And yeah, it's all about the 29 for 29 deal.
Yeah. And it's pretty funny. It cracks me up. When we first made it, I was laughing hysterically, but I didn't know if it was because, you know, I know you guys in the video, or if it was because it was just hilarious. But apparently it's just hilarious. So that's what the review's coming back. So check that out.
And I'm kind of the, what do you call it? The straight, what do you call the person in the comedy routine who's just like totally not funny? The straight man.
The straight man.
Actually, I feel like that's my role. I'm the distribution statistician, so I'm supposed to be this really like square number crunching guy.
But the funny thing is, you make me laugh more than anybody else in it because of your dramatic
reveal.
Not even that. Actually, that segment wasn't what made me laugh, but just your face when you talk about how serious you are about this discount coupon code. So it just cracks me up. But anyway, yeah, check all that out. It's a great month happening here at CD Baby. Lots of cool stuff rolling out. If you need help or have questions, feel free to hit me up on Twitter or email the podcast. I'm at K Bruner on Twitter. Lots of you reach out, and I'm happy to help you or answer any questions. And those Spotify trending reports, I'm really excited about. It's pretty cool. But that's that. 29 for 29. Check it out. members.cdbaby.com. And Chris, we have some really some good news items, some interesting news items, some interesting developments, I would say. So let's get to them.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
Sound Exchange, the performing rights organization here in the U.S., responsible for collecting performance royalties for performing artists and master recording owners, announced it paid over $800 million in 2015, a 4% increase over 2014. $211 million of that came in the fourth quarter of 2015, which was a 16% increase over 2014. If you are a recording artist or master rights owner and have yet to register with Sound Exchange, you should do so immediately. Well, rumors were flying that Spotify had been working on adding video to the service, and Spotify has just done that with the recent launch of its new video channel. The channel includes content from ESPN, Comedy Central, MTV, BBC, Vice News, Slate, and others. You can get to Spotify's videos on both Android and iOS by tapping the Browse section and then choosing Shows. Below the featured row, you'll see two choices, video shows and also audio shows. Spotify has been serving up podcasts for several months now, but the video debut has taken a lot longer and just happened. Well, a big development in how we determine what is a platinum or gold record. For the first time, the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, as many know them as, has introduced video and audio streaming equivalents into its album award methodology. Starting this month, February 2015, plays on YouTube, Vevo, Apple Music, and Spotify in the U.S. will count towards the RIAA's gold and platinum album awards. In the past, the following awards were all based on album sales. As a refresher, 500,000 album sales were gold, 1 million album sales were platinum, and 2 million plus were multi-platinum, and it probably hasn't happened in a while, but the 10 million mark was diamond. The new formula now recognizes streaming with 1,500 on-demand audio and or video song streams equaling 10 track sales, which equal one album sale. Opponents of this kind of move will point out that 1,500 YouTube plays of a single song from an album is hardly akin to the experience of buying and listening to a full LP. In addition, the streaming equivalent ratio for the RIAA's Digital Single Award in the U.S. is lengthening to reflect streaming's enormous growth in the 2+ years since the ratio was originally set. 150 on-demand streams will now be equivalent to a single download. Previously, 100 on-demand streams did the job. So, big development there, a lot of change, and because of this change, there's actually a lot of albums that their awarding has been adjusted based on their level of streams. So, some people are upset, some people think it's the right move. What do you think, Chris?
Oh, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer that stuff should be factored into the performance of a piece of music, and you know, when you're comparing it to others, and really it's a popularity contest, but you need to measure so many more different things besides just album sales, so it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how many people try to rent bots to game this system and get a bunch of Spotify plays.
I guess that's not all that different from back in the day when they counted shipped units, right? Not sold units.
Yeah, they still do that.
So record companies would just sometimes just ship way more than they knew would sell.
Well, yeah, well, what they do is how it worked. It wasn't just that they could just ship them, but they stores, like a store would get, you know, if you've got a big outlet, you know, big retail store, and say you're going to buy in, you know, 200 copies of a CD, they'll give the store a special break on the price if they keep all those copies and don't return them, or a higher percentage of them aren't returnable. So they consider those non-returnable albums as sold, even if they're sitting in the shelf or in the back room of a store. So yes, it's very possible for someone to be certified as platinum when they have only sold maybe 500,000. But the store can't return them. Yeah, it gets, you know, there's tricks. There's tricks to game, you know.
Of course.
You know, get around any sort of rules. But, you know, the interesting thing is I saw someone say that this would be like someone going into a bookstore and skimming a page, and then someone else going in and skimming a page, and then saying that after so many people did that, the book sold. While you know, that comparison, I can see where they're coming from. You know, just because someone bought an album, a CD, doesn't mean they ever listened to it. So at least with a stream, you can make the case that they may have actually listened to it.
Right, right.
So, you know, there's benefits to both methodologies, you know, that, you know, I know my parents will see an artist play and really like the show and buy an album and never put it in the CD player. And so, you know, streams in that case were actually more valuable because somebody actually listened to the music. So.
And so I know you had mentioned something about going back to adjust numbers. Does that mean that they're going back sort of over the history of YouTube plays for official music videos and counting those? Like, there doesn't seem to be any way to back, you know, like to go back 5 years and adjust Justin Bieber's numbers or something like that.
Actually, they are.
They are. Okay.
So there's a list. I won't read them all, but of artists that they went back and awarded new certifications for certain artists. You know, one was Alt J. They made them gold. Then there's people like Coldplay. They adjusted Ghost Stories to platinum. And then let's see. There's some. They Michael Jackson Thriller. They went adjusted to 32 times platinum.
Wow.
And I don't know how much it was before the adjustment. It doesn't say the before and after where I'm looking at it. But then. The Weeknd, they adjusted to 2 times platinum. So yeah, they went back. I'm not sure if they're going to keep going back through more and more, because it seems like this list of, you know, about 15 or it says 17 titles, that is clearly not the only people seeing benefits of streaming. But I think they just went and maybe made some examples right out of the gate in order to kind of make the point of how they're adjusting for it. So these are.
Just hope that Gangnam Style was recognized in that adjustment. That's what we all really care about.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't get mentioned in here. But, you know, like I said, I have a feeling this is just to show, hey, this is how we're going to adjust it. Because most of them are people that I think more benefit from it. Like somebody who was probably had 200 or 300,000 actual sales, but had tons of streaming. And so they've adjusted. So they're gold now. And right. And for reference, if you're listening outside of the U.S., your country will have its own standards for gold certification. I know in Canada and the U.K., a number needed to be considered gold or platinum is much less. So that's something that the local whatever organizations will set. That's that.
that's the good news.
Yeah. And by the way, if you have not registered for Sound Exchange, they're paying out tons of money. Go register. This is totally different than ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC. They take care of the song. Sound Exchange takes care of the recording, and it is different, and also pays you as the featured performer. And I know that I just said that, and someone will still think, I'm good, I'm already registered with ASCAP. They are different. I will repeat, go register with Sound Exchange. If you have money streaming on Pandora or satellite radio, did I say money streaming on Pandora?
if you've
got songs streaming on Pandora, they owe you money, and it is not covered. It's separate from the money you might be getting from Pandora based off of your song plays. So go sign up with Sound Exchange and make sure you're tapping into that money, because they hold on to it for a while, but you know, you don't want it to disappear.
Which it will after what, 3 years or so?
Well, Sound Exchange tends to hold on to it longer. They try to hold on to it. Lauren from Sound Exchange, who spoke at our DIY Musician Conference, she addressed that in the panel that I did with, it was called like Show You the Money, Show Me the Money panel. And she was on that panel and I asked her that question. And but in other certain circumstances with publishing money, which is separate than this, it can disappear. But Sound Exchange, you know, if they owe you, they'll pay you. But they got to know who you are and what your music is. So tap into that cash. Any other comments on the news items, Chris?
Besides the fact that I forgot what the second one even was at this
Spotify
point.
Spotify offering video on demand.
Oh, right. That's just one of those things where I feel like you and I are going to disagree, and I kind of am like, who cares? But you will have the opinion. It's a great addition, and if you're already a Spotify subscriber, why not watch content through that? So,
You think I would like it?
I think you would like it.
Actually,
I think you would see it as...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was under the assumption you would think it was an exciting development.
I'm actually in the who cares camp.
Oh, all right. You've surprised me.
I don't know why I'm in the who cares camp. I don't know. I just don't think of Spotify as a video. I've got Netflix and I've got Amazon Prime, so they're going to have much more extensive video libraries than Spotify. So I don't know. And, you know, there's always YouTube.
Right. Oh, yeah, there's always that, too. Yeah, that's kind of why I'm indifferent. I just don't think of Spotify as, you know, I'm not looking for that solution from them. I already have those needs taken care of elsewhere. And
my biggest concern is that they would water down the music experience. Like, there's some really cool things happening with playlisting and it being a very music-centric app. If they bring that on board and it starts to become a focus, I think it can water down everything and have a not great experience for everything. And that would be my biggest concern with it. You know, they have like 20,000 podcasts on there. We are not one of them because you have to use a certain podcast company in order to get your music or your podcast on there. And I haven't really engaged in that because I use a podcast catcher in order to listen to podcasts that knows what people who want to listen to podcasts, how they want to interact with it. So that's why I'm kind of in the who cares camp. I don't mind it being there. I just hope that it doesn't get their focus off of driving people further into music. So that would be my take. So we're in agreement, Chris.
All right. That's a rare thing when it comes to new digital services branching into new areas. I feel like I'm proven wrong, I think, but generally when the announcements are made, I'm like, whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think there is a history of, it may be, you know, just a short few years, but enough times people have tried to add things to an app or an experience that is not the reason people are there. I think iTunes tried it with Ping. That failed. Apple Music has tried it with Connect. I have to remind myself occasionally what that Connect button in my Apple Music is even for. And it's because people aren't there for a social network. But there are some cool things that can happen if you focus on driving people deeper into the music. So that's what I hope. I'm actually very optimistic. Speaking of, kind of tying it back to our Spotify trending reports that we launched in our CD Baby member accounts, I'm very optimistic by what I'm seeing happen there and looking at some of the data from what's happening in other artist accounts. I was looking at an artist who sells quite a bit of music through CD Baby, and by quite a bit, I mean a lot, enough that it's probably a full-time living for them. But I was kind of curious now that we have these trending reports to see what it looked like in their account, and I pulled it up, and I was shocked at how many streams they were getting. And I was sort of reflecting on how, since I've been using Apple Music and Spotify, especially Apple Music, how much more music I've been listening to and discovering bands that I've never heard of before. and actually checking out their music, listening to the album, bookmarking some stuff. And that only happens in a streaming world, I would say. If I had to buy that music, it never would have happened. So I'm optimistic that as these companies develop these platforms, that people will be listening to more and more music that they wouldn't have otherwise, and the numbers of streams that we see will be larger than the doom and gloom crowd ever anticipated.
That just happened to me a couple weeks ago. At my residency, I played a song by Harry Nilsson, and afterwards, my bass player said, "Hey, have you heard, you know, this and this and this version of that song?" And he listed a bunch of different artists who'd covered it, and I hadn't. So when I got back home, I dialed up Apple Music and I listened to most of them. It's like that would have taken me 15 years ago so much effort in going out to whatever record stores or libraries or whatever to find all these different records. I would have never done it. Like, it would have just been a pain in the ass and I never would have gotten around to it.
And they might not have even been available.
Right. And they probably wouldn't have been available because most of them were, you know, records from the 70s. So this was cool. It was like a little research project I was able to do in 10 minutes that would have taken me, you know.
Yeah,
it would never would have happened.
Yeah. Well, and another example that I was talking about Instagram at the top of the show. There's, you know, guitar gear and guitar players. This whole, like, Instagram is like their number one social network. And I'm a guitar player and I love guitar gear, so I follow a bunch of people. Well, through just some links of that, I found a band that had cool gear. They had cool photos and I followed them. And then their type of music is post-instrumental rock, which I love that kind of stuff. And I pulled them up on Apple Music and it's a great album. And then I find out they're actually distributing through CD Baby, which was another bonus. And I was have been listening to it every night for the past couple nights. And it's
Sweet.
A band I hadn't...
Who is it?
Hold on a second. Let me grab my phone. I have it right here. Minor Movements. So Minor Movements, if you're listening, I'm following you on Instagram now and I'm listening to your music because of what you posted on Instagram. So yeah, it's been really cool. So this is a band I wouldn't even ever have known existed, but because of, you know, new technology, Instagram, people connecting on a different level, I've been streaming their music a bunch this week. And so I'm very optimistic that this kind of stuff will happen more and more and artists start thinking about these things and how they promote their music in these ways as opposed to pouting about a sale, you know, that nobody bought it and they're streaming it. Yes, I want my fans to buy it. Yes, I want them to come to a show and buy a CD or go buy a download. But if they're streaming it and they keep turning on more people to stream it, I think you're just so close to that play button now, and it's easier to get people to push that play button than it is to get them to push the buy button. And it's easier, which is easier than getting them to necessarily come to a show and buy a whole bunch of merch. So it's just easier and easier to get people pushing that play button and becoming a fan of your music. So we'll talk about that more later. I want to do a show about cover songs because what you talked about, there were some things that I had in my presentation at NAMM in January that was pretty interesting about similar scenario to what you were talking about with cover songs. So we'll get to more of that later. But today we are going to talk about merch.
Yeah, speaking of merch sales.
Yeah, because you wrote an article related to your residency here in Portland about merch sales. And it was a good article, had some good points. And it's something that people get asked a lot about, and it's something that I think the merch table at a show can be a frustrating experience as an artist. And so, Chris, why don't you lead us off in the discussion about merch and give us the background for the article and some of the points you made.
Sure. So going back to the residency, I played in Oregon. It was 7 nights in a row at one venue. Part of the benefit of that is that you can leave most of your gear, you know, behind the stage. You don't have to set everything up every night. So I was really excited about setting up a merch booth that looked good and leaving it basically where it was. And each night I moved the CDs, you know, to a secure location. But So back home here in Maine, I went and I put together a small but, you know, portable but good looking little merch station that had different sections so I could highlight different CDs I've put out and things like that. Got to, you know, I flew it to Oregon. I set it up. When I walked into the venue, I basically just found the most, the table that was there that seemed most appropriate for it. Grabbed that table. There was really only one place in this venue where you could put merch. And unfortunately, it's behind a column that's basically in the very center of the room. But what could I do? I set it up there, set up some lights, et cetera, made it look as good as it could. And if you want to see a picture of what it did look like when I first set it up, that's on our article, which is called, what is it called? How to Double Your Merch Sales Overnight. So anyways, I play the first couple nights, and, you know, I sold CDs, but it wasn't, you know, I maybe sold 6, 7, 8 CDs, something like that. By Tuesday night, which was the third night of the residency, I was playing with a band called Moody Little Sister. Each night I had a different friend band come be the featured guest. Anyway, so at the end of that night, I, you know, sold another handful of single-digit CDs, and I was just feeling kind of bummed because, you know, it's my new album, and I just assumed that this would be a great opportunity to sell it, and I mentioned that to her, and she, it was funny, she was like, almost like the host of one of those makeover shows, like reality TV, home makeover or beauty makeover, whatever it is. She just like...
Merch table makeover.
Yeah, right. She should totally have her own show. She snapped like totally into gear and was like, within literally like 4 minutes, she had totally revamped my entire setup so that by the next night and through the second half of the week, I had doubled merch sales to, you know, whatever, double digits at that point. So I guess her main tips is what I put in the article, and we could go through those. And then I also have a number of other smaller tips that we could mention.
Yeah, let's go through your tips. And then I wrote down some pet peeves of mine when it comes to merch tables as from the artist perspective. And I think they're all from the artist perspective, but go ahead with your tips.
Okay, so the first thing she said, she looked at it and she said, this needs to be higher up. Right now it's basic. I had put it where the table allowed me to put it. And that's basically waist level when you're standing next to a table. And she said, people need to be like blasted with this information. It needs to be totally obvious where and what they should be looking at. And at waist level, it's, you know, even though it was clearly visible to me, and brightly lit, and I thought it was brightly lit. Anyways, she said, let's look around. What can you do? Okay, there's no other tables that are taller than this, so we got to get it up somehow. So basically what she did is she went out and got her merch table that she brings to every gig, which is very tall. And she said, why don't you just borrow this for the rest of the week? And another benefit was that that table was a lot wider than the one I was using. So I got it up to eye level, and that was her first tip. Draw the eye to, you know, make it easy for the eye to be drawn to it. And then the next thing she said was, you have to focus on one product. And it was kind of like I equated it to the end cap at a big box store. You don't usually look at an end cap and see like 6 different things. A lot of times it's just one product and you see 400 different, you know, not different, but the large quantity of one item. So she looked at my merch booth and she said, okay, you're trying to sell 6 different albums here with, you know, a little bit of a feature on your newest one. Get rid of all these other ones and make, you know, put up 6 different, put up 6 CDs of your newest album. So basically when someone looks at it, they know exactly what the most important product is. They don't have to, you know, kind of rifle through CDs and figure out which one is which. It's the message is very clear. Buy this one. Look at this one. So that was the next thing we did. We set up a bunch of those. But then I also needed to make space for all of my back catalog, which the fact that she'd given me a larger table helped out because I could put those off to the side and have space for that. But again, it was about making the messaging like totally idiot-proof in the context of a room that's often darkly lit or, you know, I'm on stage. I can't make clear to everyone which CDs they should be looking at. So that was the second thing she did. The third thing was I thought that I had it brightly lit with a little reading lamp and some of those battery tea lights that are battery powered, and as well as a strand of Christmas lights. But she said again, like, you need to make it totally idiot proof. So she strung up another strand of Christmas lights that were brighter than mine. And once she'd done that, kind of everything you needed to know became very clear from even, you know, a distance, the pricing, all that stuff. And so what that did was, I think it made it very easy for anyone in the audience who might be nervous about getting up in the middle of a show, going over to a table and kind of finding, well, what do I want to buy? How much am I going to have to pay? They could kind of process that information at their seats and then go up, basically put the money in the jar. They knew what they needed. You prevent the audience from feeling awkward about standing in front of everyone else while they're, you know, trying to give you money, essentially. That was the third thing. Number four was so simple, but I thought so brilliant. And for some reason, I'd never really like made a formal process of this before. But, you know, obviously, if you can, you want someone at your merch booth helping sell the merch and helping to guide people to the albums that they'll like the best, or, you know, find the right t-shirt size or anything like that. But if you're in a kind of smaller venue, or you just don't have someone to work merch that night for you, the next thing, her suggestion is just mention from stage that there's something called the honor system. You know, we've got a mason jar up there. Put the amount of money in, take what you want, and, you know, God will strike you dead if you rob us. But, just make sure everyone knows, again, they don't need to wait for you to get off stage. They don't need to wait for you to break your gear down or to talk to whoever else you might be talking to before you can get to the merch booth. It's like, just removing barriers from collecting that money and making that sale. So mentioning the honor system was another way of doing that. And then the last thing she said is just, you need to be mentioning your merch more, because, you know, I thought, oh, if I do it once or twice a set, and I was doing two sets a night, that's enough. But it really wasn't. Because who knows if people are paying attention or when they walked into the show, when they're leaving. And she said, but there's a ton of different ways you can do that. It's not always like, hey, we've got CDs, they're over there, they're 10 bucks. And so some of her suggestions were like, you know, do that standard one every once in a while, but also talk about your new record and why you're excited about it. And, you know, I was already sort of talking about the process of making my record and how it's different from my previous albums. And so by making the story a little bit more about the creative process, you can kind of finish it off by saying, I'm really proud of it. It's over there, whatever, 10 bucks, you're on the honor system. Or, you know, when you play any new songs from the record, you could do something as quick as, hey, this is a song from our new album. Or you could tell something about the song, about whether it's the recording process or the story behind it. And then that again ties into the, hey, if you like this song, it's on that new record. They know which one the new record is because there's 20 of them right there, all brightly lit. So, and all this kind of tied into basically making it simple for people to buy and kind of making as many introductions to the product as you can.
Yeah, those are all great tips. Merch is something that's weird because I think that as artists, I don't know, we start to take whatever happens at the merch booth personally sometimes. And so then I've been in situations where I was like, let's just not set it up tonight. And it's like, well, we're not going to sell anything if you don't set it up.
Yeah, you know what the outcome will be at that point. And I've been guilty of that before, too.
I have, too. You're like, oh, it's just too much trouble, and I can't bear to watch everyone walk by it again and just ignore it.
Yeah, sometimes you walk into a certain kind of venue, and you think, if I set up the merch booth, I'm almost like it's being presumptuous and you're just setting yourself up for defeat in a way. But the real way to set yourself up for defeat is to not do anything.
Yeah. The one that you mentioned, I think a lot of artists fail at, is the one that you mentioned, the last one you said, where mention it from the stage. I've played for somebody before. It wasn't one of my bands that I've been in, but I was just playing for them as a player, and they had an album release and they kept just saying, my CD's over there. My CD's over there. And it just kind of became this repetitive, uninspired, I'm just going to keep telling people, go buy the CD over there. And that's not the correct way to bring it up more times. Like what you said, having a story to tell, I think is important. It's not just about, hey, go buy this thing over there. It's like, hey, this item I have that I'm promoting now is an expression of all these things, and weaving it through, hey, this song that is about, and it's on my new album that's over there. Just finding ways to pull it into the conversation.
Yeah, and I think there's that sort of emotional appeal to the music, but there's also, I think you can make a practical appeal, like, you know, hey, in this crazy modern world, people can access music in a ton of different ways. Sometimes it's free, sometimes it's, you know, whatever. But if you have appreciated what you heard, the best way to support me is to buy my music here from me directly. You know, like, I think it's okay to sort of say, this helps me more than it will if you go home and stream it on Spotify or whatever. And I think if they've enjoyed your show for a half hour or 2 hours or whatever it is, like, that can mean something. And I think it's okay to lay it out like that.
Yeah, I think there's a fine line with that one. I think a lot of times artists will go overboard with that side of it. Like, go, will you guys just please go buy my album so I can eat? And that's not.
Yeah, I don't mean it like begging.
Yeah, but... no. And I just wanted, I know you didn't, but I just wanted to make that clear to people. It was funny when I was preparing for my talk at NAMM. I was mentioning, you know, doing just a real quick, what is marketing? And marketing is not, you know, spamming people on Twitter or whatever. And I did a search on Twitter just with the words buy my album. And the number one response that I saw, very unscientific way I tabulated this, but just scanning through, you know, probably a couple hundred tweets, the number one reoccurring thing was some artist saying, buy my album so I can eat. And I was like, I understand where you're coming from. I've been in that place. but that's not
a better solution might be buy me a sandwich so I can eat.
But the idea is that that's not the motivation that you should kind of fall into. While I think what you were saying is perfectly legitimate. Hey, if you're liking what you're hearing, the best way you can support us and make sure that it keeps happening is to, you know, grab the album, enjoy it, and, you know, appealing to them from that side of things, because it's about them getting more enjoyment from what they're already enjoying. It's like, hey, yeah, this thing you like, if you wanted to see it happen, as opposed to, hey, I'm poor and I could really use some food. That's like a totally different, that's about you. That's not about them.
Yeah, I posted an article maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago on our DIY musician blog called Connecting with Your Audience and Selling Merch from the Stage. It was written by, it was written about Shannon Curtis. Her husband, Jamie Hill, wrote the article. But she's a piano pop singer-songwriter. And basically the article has an embedded SoundCloud clip of one of her entire shows and points out a few moments that you can listen to in one of the shows that where she makes these kind of, either weaves a story into the set that might draw people to her merch later on, or at some point later in the show, there is an actual like sort of direct appeal to buy the merch. And so if you want to hear how one artist does it successfully, check that article out.
Yeah. Some good stuff there. And Shannon Curtis is great. She's learned a lot about performing, because she's a singer, singer-songwriter from a piano, and she actually played at our conference, and it was amazing how, you know, on this big stage in a big room, you would think, oh man, she just came on after this band, it's going to be a rough one, and she filled the room with sound and had everyone's attention, because she's just learned how to perform and connect with an audience no matter what. So big fan. I have a couple merch pet peeves. Would you like to hear them?
Would. Let's see if I committed any of them.
Well, it's not as much about you possibly, but what happens at a merch table. So one is when you ask the merch person, you know, you maybe a venue or somebody, you get a volunteer or a fan or somebody offers to do merch, sit at the table and sell your merch. and they sit and stare at their freaking phone the whole night. And people come up to the table and they don't engage with them and they stare at their phone. I've been on stage and seen that happen. Like, wanted to throw my guitar and run off the stage. Be like, would you at least?
Why are you here?
Yes, this person's about to buy our music, and instead of you encouraging it, you're turning them off by ignoring them and being rude. That's happened on a few occasions where I'm like, get off your phone. This is not the place to be on your phone. That's not why I wanted you to sit here. If you're gonna do that, just let me. Better to have an empty table.
Yeah, you'd be better off on the honor system at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Then the other one, and this happens all the time, and it's a tough one. It's tough to deal with. But it's when you as a band, you know, you play the show and you go out to the merch table, which you should, greeting fans, and a personal friend or a family member or, you know, some longtime fans that, you know, have almost kind of moved into the friend category at this point, stand blocking the merch table so no one can see and just chit-chatting. And it's, you know, it's hard as the band person to you don't want to be rude, but you're kind of like, dude, can you just not stand and block everything? And people like come and they kind of glance over the merch table, but then keep walking because you're kind of like blocked in, or they feel like they're never going to get up there or whatever. That drives me crazy.
And part of the attraction to the merch table, besides the merch, is access to you as the person who just stepped off stage. So if you're engaged with someone who's not going to buy anything, you're also preventing them from having that personal experience with you that, you know, maybe they just want to come up and say, hey, great show. But then out of that conversation, they might end up buying merch. So that's another thing it's preventing, not just the view, but
access
to you.
And that's something that I think artists probably, some people probably notice and some people might not, because it's like, hey, I'm at my table and someone's talking to me. But if you're at your table and you're talking to somebody who's you've got a relationship with beyond just that 5 minutes, move them along and say, hey, man, can I hang out with you in like half hour and chat? And I want to make sure that people know that, you know, don't walk by not seeing the merch or think that we're all tied up here, because that's happened. It's happened a lot. I've noticed, especially when, you know, it's usually closer friends or family that haven't seen you in a while. They just stand and create a wall in front of your merch booth. And you're like, all right, guys, move. I love you. Appreciate the support. But let's chat in half hour when the crowd is gone. So that's something that I've noticed happening a lot, and people mean well. Or when, you know, someone who's working the merch booth has one of their friends doing that, and that's even harder to, because like that person's not realizing, they're like, hey, I've been sitting here bored and now someone's talking to me, but they're not realizing that they're just blocking people from being able to access the merch booth. Another thing that I think is important to recognize is, you know, you mentioned in that residency you had here in Portland how the merch area was kind of an awkward spot. People had to get up and go and almost stand up in front of the audience to look at the merch and possibly buy something. So it's really important to kind of just gauge where the merch selling area is and work with the venue. They may say, hey, bands always set up here, and you notice this is a really terrible spot to be set up. Can I set up over here instead? Some venues may say no. Some may say, sure, I mean, I don't care, but that's typically where bands set up. Okay, well, bands typically set up in the wrong spot. there's a venue here in Portland that's one of the better clubs to play. They have great sound, mediocre lights, but great sound. The room is really well done. It's a cool-looking room, too. And the venue thought they were being helpful by building a merch booth into the wall. Picture a miniature concession stand. And it's the venue itself, you go downstairs, it's called the Doug Fir Lounge in Portland. The venue is downstairs. Upstairs is a hotel and restaurant. And when you go downstairs, you turn to the right, and that's the whole venue. To the left is the bathroom, and the merch booth is built into the wall, so you can't see it unless you're walking by to the bathroom. So it was so frustrating playing
there. Well, and also, it's not only is it next to the bathroom, but the only way to get to the bathroom is through this thin kind of corridor that goes by the merch booth. So everyone, you could go on from there. But
yeah, it's got a railing. It's not like an enclosed hallway, but it's got a railing. So it's this tight squeeze. It's the worst thing possible. And one of the club bookers, who's no longer there, has been gone from there for a long time, One time when I asked them about it, they got upset. I'm like, we built this gorgeous merch booth and none of the bands ever want to use it. And it makes me mad. I'm like, because you did it in the wrong spot. It becomes this choke point. I mean, people that are trying to buy merch, you say after you're done playing and there's like a rush on the bathroom, it kills your merch sales. And people going up to just walking out the venue, it's not easy for them to see that it's there because it's built into the wall. It doesn't stick out at all and it's easy to miss. And it's just frustrating because that's, you know, Hello Morning, when we were playing in Portland a lot, some of our best shows were at that club and some of our worst merch sales there because people just can't see it. And also they would make you share with other bands, which, you know, I don't have a problem sharing with other bands, but it's probably like a 4 foot, maybe 5 foot wide window where you're trying to sell all this merch through and it just doesn't work. So it's important to, you know, that venue, they would not let us move. They put their foot down, but it's important that if there's situations that you try to make sure that you understand where the flow of traffic's going to be and set up in the appropriate place.
Yeah, with my residency, there was a more ideal location as far as I was concerned, but the trouble was that it was right next to a entrance/exit, and the venue was pretty adamant about blocking that in any way. I wouldn't have blocked it, but it kind of would have been, you know, you would have had to have noticed it on your way in or out of the venue, and that was too much for them. So,
yeah, and I think the last tip I would have is to make sure you're prepared to sell. And I don't necessarily mean that you're willing to talk to people, which you should be, but that you're prepared to sell. When people go back to the booth, you're not fumbling around with stuff. Oh, where's that square reader? Ah, I got to find that thing. Check it out beforehand. Make sure everything's set up. Martin Adkins has a great tip about t-shirts. He rolls them and puts a piece of tape on the end with the size so they can all sit in a box. And someone says, I want a large of that t-shirt. And you just grab it. You're not digging through a box. Because I've done that myself and you feel stupid and you see other people leaving because they're like, oh, he's going to be a while. And you're like, oh, no, there's no larges. And, you know, in Martin's example, you're like, oh, we're out of larges. And then later on you find out, oh, you had larges. They were just in another box all folded up awkwardly. And
have proper change, or, you know, as much change as you can have, tens, fives, ones, all that stuff, so that if all they've got is a 50 or something, you don't just say, oh, sorry.
Yeah, and it's going to take more than $20 in change. You probably need at least $50 in change lots of fives, and if you have pricing where there's needs for ones, get tons of ones in, because it doesn't take long. Two people buying something, you know, a $10 CD or a $5 trinket, or, you know, something, they hand you a $20 bill and they can clean you out pretty fast. And then I've actually lost out on sales because not having enough change and having to go, wait, I'll be right back. I got to see if I can get change from the bartender. Then you're like waiting in line. I need change. And it's like, that's ridiculous. Get it done. And the one thing I would mention with the square reader is I've been in the situation where the venue didn't have Wi-Fi and the venue had really bad cell service, like that one I mentioned, the Doug Fir. They were in a basement. I think it worked out okay there. But I also been in another venue where there was like we were in a like cell phone no man's land and they didn't have Wi-Fi. And so I couldn't use the square reader. So you got to kind of check things out ahead of time and be ready to go. So when people are back there, the 10, 15 minutes after you play, when it's like go time, that there's nothing holding you back from making the sale, because that really is a bummer.
Yeah. I have a few more quick tips. Was that all of your pet peeves?
That's all of it. Let's hear it.
So, okay. The obvious thing, set it up first and break it down last, because you never know when a sale is going to take place. You could have ended your set and hung around the bar for an hour drinking with your friends, whatever, and then someone who also was hanging around just decides to buy at that point. So make sure it's the last thing you break down. What else? If you can, bring a tablecloth or a banner or something like that you can throw under it so you can cover up any, you know, if it's a crappy table or whatever, so it'll look cool. And one thing we've talked about in the past is keeping your pricing sort of variable based on the venue. So if you go and you're playing at, you know, some corporate event with a bunch of rich people, go ahead and charge $15 to $20 for your CD. If you're playing in, you know, a punk rock dive where everyone is drinking like the $2 beer special, maybe your CD is $5 to $10, or pay what you want. And don't be afraid to switch around the pricing like that. the other thing I was going to say was,
oh, to keep in mind who your buyers are, because it's not always just your sort of average attendee. Like in my case, even though a range of age groups come to my shows, you know, people in their 20s and people in their 70s, it tends to be people in their 40s and 50s and 60s who are actually buying my merch. So obviously the CD is going to be hopefully applicable to everyone. But when I think about t-shirts or other kind of merch items, I need to keep in mind the demographic of my most likely or my most frequent customers. So I think that's another thing to keep in mind.
Yeah, the pricing.
I think that's it. And run deals, you know, for 3 for 2, 5 for 3, whatever.
The pricing is a good tip because when we were doing our Christmas albums and playing some shows to support them, one of the guys in the band was like, "We need. What should we charge? Is $10 too much?" I'm like, $10? We're charging at least 15. And that weekend we had a residency at a place. We sold like $1,500 worth in just CD sales alone. I was like, "Hey, if we charged $10, we would have just given away $500." He's like, "Yep, you're right." I'm like, "This audience will pay 15. This isn't the audience that's scraping together $5 out of a couch to come to the show." So, know your audience and don't be afraid to charge, because at the show they're not buying just a CD. They're buying an experience. They're buying memorabilia, and that costs money. And people are used to paying for that. So don't shortchange yourself just because you think no one wants to pay for stuff.
Yeah, especially when you think about a giant concert that you've gone to by one of your favorite artists. Like, how much is a t-shirt? $50 or something? You could probably get the same thing on Amazon for like 18, but it's part of the experience of that, oh, you bought it at the concert.
Yep, exactly. Well, I'd love to hear any feedback artists have, anyone there listening. If you've got a picture of a merch table that you're proud of, or some tips or some horror stories relating to selling merch, feel free to call our listener line at 360-524-2209. And I did just mention that if you had a picture, you know, we'd like to see it, but you can't do that on the listener line. So I believe you can just pop that into the comment section on the show notes at cdbabypodcast.com. I believe you can post a photo there. If not, email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com and we'll try and get it posted. But I'd love to see what other bands are doing with merch displays. You know, there's giant merch displays, and we've had that with Small Town Poets, like the, you know, big venue type display. But then there's some cool small displays I've seen that are kind of classy and easy to set up, but still make a good presence. So if you've got some interesting merch stuff to show, send it on over, and I want to hear your stories. And so 360-524-2209. And with that, Chris, we have a couple calls and a couple emails. What would you like to start with first?
Oh, let's do the calls first.
Hi, Kevin. This is Evan Hulse from Seattle. I have a question. What would be the best way to research a band name, and what would be the best way to secure that band name? Thanks.
All right. That was a quick, simple, but yet good question. You heard that all right, Chris?
I think researching a band name.
Yes, yes, yes. He wanted to know what's the best way to research a band name. And, you know, honestly, you start with doing, if you've got a band name idea, first thing you do, do a Google search. See what comes up. At this day and age, there's a good chance your band name, the .com, will probably be taken. If it's, you know, taken by a band, then keep moving. Another place you might look is, you know, because a Google search, you'll get so many things. And depending on the band name, you might get so many random results that rank higher than finding another band name. So, but Google's the first place to start. After that, go to like cdbaby.com, do it, search there. If it doesn't come up, there's an even better chance it's available. Then I would go to something like SoundCloud and search, and Bandcamp. And if you've searched in all those places and there's no band with that name, I think you're free and clear. But the next consideration would be the .com or whatever URL is available, because it could be that you found a cool band name, but there's some very prominent companies that have the same name. It may not be an issue. It might. It just depends on whether or not you care that people are going to their website by accident, or if you're able to come up with a memorable URL around your band. A lot of bands that have that issue will add like official or something to the URL in order to be able to differentiate themselves. But those are the places I would start. Do you have anything to add, Chris?
Well, I don't know if this might be obvious, but when you're Googling, you know, let's say you wanted to be the Police. Don't just Google the Police. I mean, well, obviously you'd find Sting's band because they're super famous now, but you'd also find how many police departments across the world or anything written about the police force. Or so, like, you know, to the Police music, the Police band, the Police, you know, kind of narrow your search that way. Which
yeah.
Might be obvious, but.
Yeah, that, no, that's a good tip because I think a lot of people don't think about that. Yeah. Do, you know, band music, or, you know, touring or anything that a band might be using to describe themselves, and that'll help. And, you know, then if you do find someone that has a similar name, then it's a tough call. If you really attach to the name, I mean, there's some bands that there's like 20 or 30 bands with the same name, and that can be challenging, not ideal, and I wouldn't recommend it. But, you know, there is some ways to get around that. Just depends on what you want to do. If it's a, you know, just kind of a pet project in your bedroom, it probably doesn't matter. If it's something that, you know, you're a band or you're trying to go build an audience with something and go on tour and stuff, then you really should find a name that's free and clear and no issues whatsoever. And it's becoming a bigger challenge. It's really hard.
There was a comment this morning on the DIY Musician blog from a guy who, I forget what state he lived in, but he said, hey, my band name, we started a band and we called it, I forget what it was exactly, it was the something Slingers, you know, like the Good Time Slingers or Old Time Slingers, something like that. And they spelled Slingers with a Z at the end of it. And he said, you know, because we thought it was catchy and memorable. And then there's another band 20 miles away with the exact same name. Only they spell theirs with an S, and that band, you know, this guy said, hey, will you stop using that because we're in the same market, we have the same name, it could be very confusing for club owners and people who want to come see us. And that band apparently said, no, because we have the S on our name and we're spelling it normal, it's obvious that you stole the name from us and then changed it to the Z. So anyways, they're in the same exact market. I was like, that sucks. And like, I don't know what you do in that case, but...
Change your name,
probably.
Or wait for the other band to break up. That's the other option.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's bad news. That's why you need to do some research. In the same market, yeah, that's just not going to work, even with those, that different, you know. If they were in different markets, I'd say, ah, you're fine. But in the same market, especially if it's like two rock bands, yeah, you're gonna have problems. Unless, you know, you ride it out for a little bit. If they've got a bigger fan base... You write it out for a little bit, so enough confusion, your fans come to your shows too, and then you get them on your list, then you change your name. That's how you do it. So yeah,
or
so very
maybe
important.
Both fans could just join and become one.
That's right. The
monster band.
There's the real solution. then everybody wins. So all right, cool. We got another call. So that was a good question. That was a great question. Here's another one.
Hey Kevin, this is Juan from Sofa City Sweetheart. I think I tweeted some ridiculous music predictions for 2016 a couple weeks ago. Anyway, I was just listening to this old podcast and trying to catch up because I was subscribed to the podcast on iTunes and then it stopped updating them for some reason. So I just found that I'm like 50 episodes behind now or something, so I'm trying to catch up. But just something that might help, and I know a lot of other people try to, when they first discover the podcast, probably binge listen. There's probably a lot of binge listeners out there. So just thought you might want to say the date that you guys are recording the podcast. Because I think I'm listening to the one right now where it's you guys are talking about the DIY conference in Chicago. I know that happened a little while ago, but I'm just trying to get a time reference because sometimes I put all my episodes on the... on my iPod, and I'll catch up. But sometimes it'll be a more current episode that I'm listening to. Or sometimes it'll be an old one talking about, like, MySpace strategies. So I just want to, you know, stuff that might help the listeners out there, say the date that might help, because my iPod won't show it on my little, because I have it connected to my car, and so it won't show the date on there. Anyway, just thought, but thanks for all the good work. Long-time listener, first-time caller, if you want to hear any music, Silver City Sweetheart on CD Baby. And I'm putting out a new record soon, so that will definitely be going on there. Okay, thanks again for all the great podcasts.
All right, thanks for that call. There's a reason that we don't necessarily mention the date. Chris, can you tell me what that reason is? Do you even know why I don't ever mention the date?
Is it because you don't want people to feel like the information is aging?
No, this is so much more practical and so much more obvious. The reason we never mention the date...
I know why now, because the episode never airs on the date we record it.
Bingo. That's the reason why I tend to not mention the date, because I think if I did, it'd be far more confusing. And a little peek behind the curtain. Usually an episode like this where you hear Chris and I talking and there's news and stuff, we tend to get up posted a couple days after. I try to get it, you know, within a day, but, you know, it just depends on schedules and what's going on. And however... sometimes there's technical issues, which happened with our last episode like this that delayed it a few more days with some random adjustments to our firewall at work, preventing me from uploading the MP3 file. But then there's other things that with interviews, I usually do a chunk of interviews at once, and then I'll release them over time. So some interviews that you've heard have actually been recorded months in advance. Sometimes it's a matter of record an interview with somebody and then something happens in current events that'd be weird if Chris and I didn't address it on the podcast, you know, with like a big news item, like the launch of Apple Music would be a perfect example. And that's exactly why I bumped one of the episodes, interviews I did that ended up airing much later, because Apple Music was coming out. I'm like, it'd be really weird for us to not do an episode the week of Apple Music launching about Apple Music. So that's why I don't ever include the date we're recording. I hope to someday, it would be great to be doing like every once in a while, maybe once a month, do a live recording where we get people to ask questions live on the podcast. There's a couple services that have popped up that allow to do that. And I know some other podcasts I listen to do that. And it seems like a lot of fun. And it's just a matter of we gotta make that happen. But that's why we don't ever mention the date. Just because they aren't always released in order that they were recorded. Now they know the secret behind it all.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it would be a helpful reference even to get the month or season or year. Then it seems a little bit too vague, though, because if you're really trying to listen sequentially, you're going to want to know.
Yeah.
Kind of the exact. So just listen for the episode number, I guess.
Episode number, and the MP3 will always be stamped with the date it was uploaded. We have some emails, a couple emails, but reminder, if you want to call 360-524-2209, appreciate those calls. They were great calls and we want more of them. But I've got a couple emails here. This one is from Stevie Z. Hey, Kevin, loving the CD Baby podcast as always. You guys are awesome. Tell your bosses to give you all raises for the extra work you do for the podcast. That should work. I like Stevie already. I've got a question for you guys. I'm adding a page to my website specifically for updates on my album that I'm finally recording. That's where I'm going to post photos, videos, and then just link to the social media sites. Here's the one thing I'm not sure of, though. Demos. Personally, I've always been very uptight about anyone hearing my stuff until I consider it finished. Plus, my songs tend to change a lot from demo to finished product. And I'd be worried that someone might listen to the demo or two and think, those songs suck. I don't want to hear any more from this loser. I know that there's a long history of bands and artists performing songs live in front of people and working them into shape that way, and I do perform the working versions live to help sand off the rough edges, but posting a demo online seems like a different animal to me. Am I just being paranoid? How do you feel about demos as promotional material? Thanks again, Stevie Z. What's your opinion, Chris?
So I think you should release your polished version first, the one you're most proud of that you think will be, you know, really impactful. then go ahead and release all that other stuff. Because if someone likes what you're doing, it could be fascinating to see the journey the song went through. Even if the first demo sounds like crap, like my demos are terrible. I record them on iPhone voice recorder thing. You know, they sound terrible. I'm out of tune. I'm forgetting lyrics. It's because I'm like sort of just getting the song idea down. But I think that if someone really loved what they hear on the album, that could be really cool for them to experience, like, oh, they're getting the song as it's happening almost. So,
yeah, I tend to agree with you. I've had this happen on multiple levels to me where it's been very clear that the average person does not understand the creative process. So while you're recording a demo, and actually I have this happen with my wife. I'm like, hey, look, this song idea. She's like, why does it sound so terrible? I'm like, well, don't look at that. And be like, the average person cannot see inside your head and hear what you're hearing and see, you know, all the stuff that you plan on doing to it. So if it's a song, like, say you're a new artist and you need to get something out there in order to get a gig, yes, take whatever song sounds the best and make it available in some way so people understand that it can have some frame of context. But if you've got albums out there and you're releasing new material, I think you have to be pretty selective with what you release ahead of time because they just won't understand what they're hearing. And I've seen it over and over again that people, they're not going to grasp the creative vision you have because it's your creative vision. It's not theirs. And the creative process is very confusing and completely unknown to some folks. And so they won't understand what you mean by demo in many cases. But, you know, again, case by case basis, but my general answer would be the same as Chris, is that it's really cool for people to go back, to hear the finished product, enjoy a song, and then hear the beginnings, because then they do understand the creative process. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's enjoyable for people to kind of get the behind the scenes look at how it came from this weird idea on an iPhone. And now it's this cool song that I love. So
and there are instances of people who record really good sounding, like stripped down demos of songs, like Elvis Costello's first, his first couple records. He did really, super passionate, just solo acoustic versions of all those songs, just probably him and a mic or maybe two mics. And they were captured in such a way that they sound good. And you can tell if you listen to it, that could have been a fully, like that could have been the recording just in a different context. It's not like a new wave band. It's just this solo singer songwriter, but the song's still awesome. So if you approach it that way and your songs are more kind of formed early on, then I think you could even distribute those demos, and release it as a, you know, a bonus thing that you can hear on Spotify or whatever, you know. Otherwise, maybe it's best to just share the demos on Facebook or whatever, you know, something that's less formalized in terms of it being massively available.
Yeah, agreed. All right, I've got another one. Hey, Kevin and Chris. Hello from sunny Costa Rica. This show is international. First of all, thank you for the DIY Musician Podcast. I've been a longtime listener, and I've learned so much throughout the years. I'm sure it has touched the lives of thousands of artists around the globe. Keep up the awesome work. It matters. Now to my question. I'd like to find a graphic designer or service with experience in music. I'd like to team up with this person so they really get to know me, my vision, and my music, so all my artwork, ads, banners, and graphic elements are a cohesive extension of me. Do you know of any service or agencies that could do this? I'm not looking for free, but also, I'm not a major label artist, so pricing has to be somewhere in between. I'm gladly pay for quality. I've used services like 99 Designs and Fiverr before, but I feel like everything there is sort of one-off and can't build a relationship with the designer in order for them to understand me or actually care. Any ideas or pointers? Again, thank you very much for the awesome work with the podcast. I'm hoping to join you at the DIY Musician Conference this year. Regards, Alonzo. Well, Alonzo, I hope you can make it as well. That'd be great to have a contingency from Costa Rica. This was a tough one. I'm not sure I have a perfect answer for Alonzo. I know what he's saying and where he's coming from, that when he's trying to see your music career and start building it as sort of a brand, that it helps to have consistent imagery and somebody who you can just kind of tap every once in a while and say, hey, I need another show poster, not have to explain who you are from start to finish for them to understand and even get close to the right artistic vision. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I have a couple like specific recommendations. I don't know if that's exactly what he's looking for. I have a relationship like that with a couple friends of mine who have done a number, you know, probably 10 concert posters, my new album art, press photos. They kind of get my aesthetic. And so if I have a need, they're pretty quickly responsive and they don't have to go through all the like, well, yeah, what are you all about? And so they're called Chicken 3000. You can look them up, and you know they're definitely professional designers, but they also work with artists all the time, and they understand that you don't have huge budgets. And now that I've mentioned their name, they're probably not going to be able to have time to work with me anymore because everyone's going to be writing them. But and then the
and
other
they do
guy
good
that,
work too. I thought all the design that they've been doing for you has been nice.
Yeah, they're good. They're cool people too. The other guy, I'm not sure. I don't know if he's trying to like build up his roster of clients right now, but he's very nice. His company, his name's Dylan. His company is called Tiny Little Hammers. So you can check that out. He has a Tumblr site with a bunch of his concert posters and album covers. I've worked with him in a similar way before too. So yeah, check them out. Beyond that, I'm not sure. I mean, I definitely think it's worth starting a relationship with a designer who you can, you know, tap quickly and not have to go through the whole aesthetic, building your aesthetic process with them every time.
Yeah, and I agree because you do waste a lot of time with a designer, and a lot of times there's frustration going back and forth. You're like, no, that's not what I meant. I meant this. And just trying to figure out how to communicate with each other. So I think,
I mean, that definitely, that even that still happens with these two people that I work with a lot, but at least it's like you kind of know each other at this point, and it's become, that's all just part of the process that you're familiar with and you understand you're going to get into. But yeah.
Yeah, there's, I think finding a small design company or just a independent designer is helpful. They're usually more flexible with what they'll charge and can work with you more. There's websites like Behance. If you search, go to Behance.com, it's a place where designers just kind of display their work. You can usually find some people in your area and connect with them. And, you know, it's kind of, they display their work and you can hone in on stuff you like. Even if you don't get a designer from there, that's a great place to actually help, kind of guide your visual, tastes as far as, you know, so you can get the conversation going with a designer based on something you've seen that's been good, so they know what you're talking about. Because that's always the tough part about working with the new designers, just trying to get them to understand the style you're going for and the language that, you know, the visual language you're wanting to portray. So I hope that helps. If anyone has any recommendations, we'd love to hear it. Email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com or call the listener line or leave a comment on the show notes, and we'll make sure Alonzo hears about it. And DIY Musician Conference, we have not officially announced this yet, but we are moments away from doing so. Will be September 30th through October 2nd. So it's a little bit earlier this year. So September 30th through October 2nd, 2016 in Chicago. Be there. This is the one conference you should go to. We're keeping it affordable again. The pricing will be announced soon, and early bird pricing. And it's going to be a little bit warmer. We moved it up a little bit. But the reason we moved it up, Chris, I don't even know if you knew this, is because it was going to be more expensive for the artists to get hotel rooms if we kept it at that same time frame. So we moved it up to a weekend where the hotel would still be more affordable and give people more options. And it's going to be a really cool event. New stuff that we're adding that was requested by the attendees last year. And I can't wait to go.
It was a blast.
So be listening to that. And Alonzo, we hope that to see you there. We're going to have some folks from, we have somebody in our call center, Barbie, who's from Argentina. I know Argentina is not Costa Rica, but we're trying to have a Latin American kind of artist meetup because we're going to have Barbie come with us and represent for us, for people that are coming from countries where Spanish might be their first language, and she's a blast, and so we can connect you guys, and you'll have a great time in Chicago. I think that's everything.
We've covered it all.
We've covered it all. And don't forget 29 for 29. $29 album submissions. When
are you? Forget that code.
You'll never forget that code. Go check out the videos online. You'll get to see Chris do some acting. It's worth it. You'll find that the CD Baby, the CD Baby YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/CD Baby or CD Baby Video. They both get you there. And yeah, check that out. Distribute your albums. Get them out there. You're not going to make money from your music if people can't go somewhere where they enjoy music and stream it, buy it, or engage with it. So distribute your music worldwide. It's the month to do it. Don't pay annual fees. We got Spotify trending. I just like looking at them every day. I just like looking at those Spotify trending reports.
Lander, Lander
integration and more about Lander coming up. But I use Lander. I've been using Lander recently to master the bumper music that I've been using on the podcast. So episodes from now on will have had bumper music that most of the time it's bumper music I've written and recorded here at home and mastered Lander, and it makes it sound so much better. So if you're releasing a single or just have music that you want to sound better, it is perfect. If you've got a track, a live track, you're just putting on YouTube or distributing, it's a perfect solution. You can do it right from your member's account now. So
you can also, before you have to pay, you can hear what you're going to get. You basically do an A-B test of the original mix and then the mastered Lander version. And then if you like it, then you pay and you get the file. But there's no monetary commitment to figure out what it can do for your music.
Indeed. So, all right. I think we've made it. We've made it to the end.
An hour and a half older now.
Yes, we are. But you just can't stop a good thing when it's going. I just want to keep talking. So,
the snowstorm is still going too.
Oh. Well, have fun with that. All right. Well, again, email us, call us, leave comments on the website, and we'll catch you next time.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.